1973. She and her husband are in the Vanaprastha order since 1996.
And they recording have in progress.
Children, 14 grandchildren and 2 great-grandsons. She has a PhD in education and was a primary and secondary teacher for 27 years and has 19 years of experience with school management. She helped start the Grihastha Vision Team, which is coordinating courses and materials to strengthen marriage and the family in ISKCON, North America. Urmila is the chair of the Shastric Advisory Council to the GBC, was an associate editor of Back to Godhead for 30 years, and formerly a professor of sociology of religion at Bhaktivedanta College. She travels worldwide teaching Krishna consciousness. She's the author of Essence Seekers, Dr. Best Learn to Read, an 83-book literacy program, and the Great Mantra for Mystic Meditation. We look forward to hearing from Prabhu. Thank you so much.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So it's April 9th, 2022. This is with iFast, and we're going to be going through the Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, chapter 13, Descriptions of the Descendants of Dhruva Maharaj, and we're doing verses 1 to 18. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvisesa Sunyavadi Paskatyade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Manchakalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhavyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. So we're going to start off with text 1. I've been asked to go through the Sanskrit of text 1, and then we'll just go through the English and the purports of the other verses. So text 1, Sutta Uvacha Nisamyako Sharavit Nisamyako sharavin opavarnitam dhruvasya vaikunta pradadirho hyatanam prarudha bhavo bhagavatya hokshaje prastum punastam vidura prachakrame. Suta Goswami, continuing to speak to all the rishis headed by Shanaka, said, after hearing Maitreya Rishi describe Dhruva Maharaj's ascent to Lord Vishnu's abode, Vidura became very much enlightened in devotional emotion, and he inquired from Maitreya as follows. So if we look closely at the Sanskrit, the word for word, we find we have this parudha bhavaha. Bhavaha means a feeling. Bhava can apply to the stage going from sadhana bhakti, from the practice of bhakti to perfection, that the first stage of perfection is bhava, and after that is prema. That's a little simplistic, because depending on which particular rasa one has with the Lord, one may progress a little differently. But bhava in the system of going from Shraddha to Prema is the beginning bud of devotional life. One is no longer practicing. One has attained perfection, but it is not mature perfection. You could think as a material allegory. So a person is practicing playing a musical instrument. They're practicing. And finally they get to perform professionally. But of course, they're still a novice. Even though they're starting to perform professionally, they're not a virtuoso yet. So in bhava, one is not practicing anymore, one is performing, but still immature. But bhava can mean something else as well. Bhava can also mean the varieties of spiritual emotion. And Srila Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu describes that rasa, the taste, the pleasure that one gets in bhakti is made up of five bhavas. The sthi bhav, which is the basic relationship with Krishna. Krishna is the Lord. Krishna is my master. Krishna is my friend. Krishna is my son. Krishna is my lover or husband. And then also the sattvika bhavas, the involuntary expressions of that love, like hair standing on end and crying. The vyavichari bhavas, which are the various transient emotions that go through one. The anubhavas, which are the voluntary expression. And the vibhavas, which are what stimulates that love. Krishna, devotees similar to oneself, and various things associated with Krishna and the devotee. So bhava can also mean these five ingredients that make up taste. And bhava can also mean generally an emotion, a feeling, an ecstasy. So in Srila Prabhupada's purport here, he writes about how that the devotees feel that Krishna is ever fresh, that everything having to do with Krishna is ever fresh, it's new, it's fascinating, that one is not, doesn't become satiated. Now it's interesting, Prabhupada writes, devotees are never satisfied or satiated, but those two things mean a little bit different things. Because in one sense, although we can say the devotees are never satisfied, we can also say the devotees are always satisfied. Tushyanti cha ramanti cha mach chita magata pranam bodhiyantas prasparam katayanchastamam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha. When we talk about Krishna, we feel great satisfaction and great happiness, but we never feel satiated. In material life, one feels satiated, but not satisfied. In material life, one feels like, okay, I've had enough. I don't want any more, right? Yesterday, I had dinner with my grandkids, and they made burritos. And after one big burrito, I was satiated. I didn't want to eat any more. My granddaughter said, would you like another burrito? No, thank you. Would you like a tostada? No, thank you. I didn't want any more. I was satiated, right? Now, you could also say I was also satisfied, but the satisfaction was very temporary. And I can't say that by eating one burrito with my family, I was completely satisfied in all respects. My hunger was satisfied, and some desire for friendship was satisfied. But it wasn't any kind of full satisfaction. But still, I was satiated. And even one could say, as far as relationship happiness, I was also satiated. Okay, I'm hanging around with my family, and now I'm done with being hanging around with my family. I'm satisfied. I don't want to stay with them every minute of every day. Whereas when it comes to Krishna, one is fully satisfied, but one is never satiated. One always feels like one could get more and more and more. For many, many years, before I would go to sleep at night, I would assess my day. How did I do today? Did I have a good day? Did I have a productive day? And I would think, you know, did I chant my rounds nicely? What work did I get done? And I would always think of how much time did I spend reading or studying Shastra. And after many years, I realized that I never felt satiated with however long I had spent studying and reading the Shastra. Because at first it was like, oh, I only spent a half an hour reading today. Oh, it's not enough. I only spent 2 hours reading today. Oh, that's not enough. And at one point I realized that even if I spent 8 or 10 hours reading and studying the Shastra, I never felt when I went to bed that, oh, that's enough. I'm satiated with how much time I've spent hearing about Krishna. So it's like it was kind of an epiphany for me that there wasn't some quantity of reading and studying that I could do where I would say, oh, okay, I've done enough reading and studying for today. And after that epiphany, I decided to focus a lot more on the quality of my study rather than on the quantity. But even then, I'm never feeling that it's enough. you know, I could have gone deeper. I could have relished it more. I could have discussed it more. And it's interesting that in the description of the degrees of love, Rupa Goswami describes in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu in the Western Ocean the degrees of love that one has with Krishna according to the different rasas that one has. So there's different degrees of love. In neutrality, it's just ordinary and intense. but in the others, it goes higher and higher and different varieties of intensity. And it's in the conjugal ras, the description, which is actually in Ujjwala Nilamani rather than Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is that a very high expression of love in conjugal is called anuraga. And anuraga comes right before Mahabhava. And the description of anuraga is that Krishna always appears fresh. Either Krishna as a whole or some aspect of Krishna, Krishna's flute playing, or Krishna's kindness, or Krishna's mercy. And it's interesting, I find, that Rupa Goswami only describes this in relation to the conjugal rasa and describes this as the penultimate expression of the conjugal rasa. However, this quality of Krishna being ever fresh and ever new is actually experienced by all the devotees. And it's even experienced by the sadhakas. In fact, it's experienced even by people who have just a very slight connection with Krishna consciousness. I'm sure that I'm not experiencing this on the level of the gopis by any means, but this feeling that there's always something fresh and there's always something new, and it doesn't become boring. You know, we're seeing the deities daily, and it's never boring. You know, they're not some ordinary stone or wood or metal sculptures. You know, you could go to an art museum and you can look at a sculpture, but would you go every day and stare at the same sculpture? You know, it's not likely. Or, you know, people have art in their home. When I grew up, my parents had a lot of original artwork in the home, oil paintings and sculptures. And after a while, it just becomes part of your life. It's not that interesting anymore. You're not going to be staring at the artwork. Or I used to give tours at the Fisher Mansion, our temple in Detroit. And people come for the first time and they're in awe. Oh, there's 24 karat gold in the floor and Venetian glass in the columns, and there's a hand-tooled leather ceiling, and they're in awe. But after you give tours, and it becomes old. It becomes boring. Oh yeah, there's gold in the floor, and there's, you know, the wow factor is gone. So also Rupa Goswami explains that this wow factor, the Adbhuta Ras, which is a secondary saibhav, it's a secondary essential element of love, is present in all relationships of love and in all taste. There's always some wow factor. There's always some astonishment. And this adbhuta ras, this astonishment, is present every time we talk about Krishna, every time we hear about Krishna, every time we think about Krishna, every time we see Krishna. There's some wow factor there. Now, Prabhupada writes here in this purport that non-devotees may be mystified by this. So Rupa Goswami also gives the explanation that if we don't love somebody, then even very extraordinary things they do don't produce a sense of wonder and astonishment in us. There's some experiments that have been done where some of the best musicians in the world, you know, people that to go to see them perform, you have to pay hundreds of dollars to go to hear and see them perform. So they would go out and pretend to be a street musician, and they would take their instrument, you know, their violin that's worth $5 million. And so there's this violinist where he's famous all over the world. People are paying, you know, $500 to hear him play in a symphony hall. And he takes his $5 million violin and he stands on a street corner as an experiment. And people just walk past. You know, at the end of the day, maybe he's collected $25 in donations, and they'll set up cameras as part of the experiment, and most people just, they don't pay attention. They just walk past him. Maybe they stop for a moment or two. So because they don't have any relationship with this person, there's no sense of wonder. Even though he's performing, you know, one of the best violinists in the world on one of the best violins in the world and performing some of the most difficult violin pieces, there's no wonder. And yet, if it's someone we love, let's say we have a little child or grandchild or nephew or niece, and, you know, they're learning how to walk or they're learning how to talk, and they're saying, you know, instead of saying thank you, they're saying danku, danku, and we're all excited that this little child, right, we give them a toy and they say danku, and we're so excited, and we're writing, we're taking videos, and we're posting the videos on social media, we're saving them for, you know, till the kid's 30, and we'll show him the videos. So because there's love, and because there's love, therefore there's this feeling of wonder. Yeah? So therefore the non-devotees don't understand. The non-devotees are just like, how is it possible that, you know, you're feeling this sense of wonder, you're feeling this sense of newness in connection with the Lord. They just don't get it. You know, but because we have love for the Lord, we have affection for the Lord, he's always new. Now, one interesting thing to remember is, my dear friends, the Lord has affection for us. The Lord has more affection for us than anybody we have ever met in our lives. Now, I'd like you to think of somebody who really, really, really loves you. And you know they really, really love you. And imagine that you were to go to them and say, I'd like to tell you everything I did yesterday. I'd like to recap my whole day. My guess is that that person would get bored. You know, maybe 10 minutes, maybe a half an hour. But they would get bored, especially if you told them the details of your day. You know, if you had a particularly interesting, amazing day. But if you said, well, you know, I got up, I looked at my clock, and I brushed my teeth, and I brushed my hair, and, you know, I used the toilet, and I took a shower, and I decided, am I going to put on my sari with the green border or my sari with the pink border? And I decided to put... I mean, immediately everybody's falling asleep, no matter how much they love you. But Krishna, Ishvara Sarvabhuta Namridesha Junatistati, Krishna's in our heart, and he's actually interested. Krishna's actually interested whether we're wearing the green scarf or the purple scarf, and whether our shoes are fitting us, and, you know, whether or not we appreciated the robin in the tree. He's interested. He's interested in everything we're thinking and everything we're doing, and he finds us fascinating. He finds us absolutely fascinating. And I'd be very surprised if any of us had anybody in our lives who finds us 1 billionth as fascinating as Krishna finds us. Now, as I say, even people who love us very, very much and really care about us and are really concerned about us, they're not that interested. Like, okay, can you get to the point? Yeah, it's a nice story, but I have some things, I have something, you know, right? So this is reciprocal. It's not just that we're finding Krishna ever fresh. Krishna's finding us ever fresh. And this is the reciprocal relationship that, and also anuraga is that we're finding aspects of our love for Krishna ever fresh, and he's finding aspects of his love for us ever fresh. And again, in our material relationships, this doesn't tend to happen. It tends to get old. You know, one of the reasons people like a dog is that when they come home, the dog gets all excited. You know, no matter how many times they've come home, when they walk in the door, the dog gets all excited. But our human relations, they may not get so excited when we come home. Hi, I'm home. I'll be with you in a minute. Fixing the washing machine. Or I didn't even know you went out. Where'd you go? So we're looking for that. But we will find that in Krishna. And even as beginners, in sadhana, we can find this. Okay, let's go into text 2. Vidur inquired from Maitreya, "O greatly advanced devotees, who were the Prachetas? To which family did they belong? Whose sons were they? And where did they perform the great sacrifice?" Now, the reason Vidur is asking this is that Maitreya had explained that Narada Muni was telling the story of Dhruva to the Prachetas. He went to the Prachetas and said, "Let me tell you about my disciple Dhruva and how he just went back to Godhead." Now, we do this, right? We contact our friends and we say, "My kid just graduated. My kid just got married. My kid just had a baby." So Narada Muni's all excited that his disciple Dhruva has gone back to Godhead in a Vaikuntha airplane. So he's going to tell the Prachetas. Now, we notice here that Maitreya had mentioned this. Now, why did Maitreya mention this to Vidura in the last chapter? So a really expert preacher and a really expert teacher always gives the listeners something to incite their curiosity to go on. Something. And we find this throughout the Bhagavatam. We also find it in the Bhagavad Gita, but we really find it in the Bhagavatam. That whoever's speaking, you know, whether it's Maitreya or Narada or whoever it is, Sukadeva himself, they're interweaving hints of things so that the people listening will go, oh, what about that? Oh, what about that? Oh, what about that? Or they'll end on what we call a cliffhanger. So this is an important aspect of being a good teacher and a good preacher. You can bring up a question in the beginning of your class that you say, "We'll get to that later." And people are, "When are we going to get to that? What's the answer?" Or you just throw out something without explanation and people will think, "Huh, what's that? What's that?" So that's what Maitreya did. Okay, going on to text 3. Vidura continued, "I know that the great sage Narada is the greatest of all devotees. He has compiled the Pancharatrika procedure of devotional service and has directly met the Supreme Personality of Godhead." All right, well, we have something a little interesting here. Srila Prabhupada in this purport is talking about the Bhagavat Marg and the Pancharatrika Vidhi Marg. And it's fascinating because it seems difficult from this purport to understand what the difference is. I mean, Srila Prabhupada is saying here, the Bhagavad Vidhi is a system of 9 processes which begin with hearing and chanting. And then Pancharatrika is particularly deity worship. But deity worship is one of the 9 processes. It's archana. And in fact, if we look at the 64 angas of bhakti, a lot of the angas of bhakti would come under the general heading of deity worship. So it seems like deity worship is part, it seems like Pancharatrika Vidhi is part of Bhagavat Marg, and therefore, how is it that they're 2 separate systems exactly? So this may be a little hard to discern. Now, how are we going to figure that out? What exactly does that mean? So I think before I answer that question, I'd like to ask all of you, do you have any insight into this Bhagavat Marg and this Pancharatrika Marg? Anybody? Yes, Mahalakshmi.
Well, I am both, although I am not so knowledgeable, but I thought that because Bhagavad Marg describes who God is, and then one can worship God properly.
All right. That's very insightful. So you're thinking of Bhagavat Marg as we hear about, and then Panchatrika as we do. Okay, someone else. We have something here in the chat. Panchatrika is with rules and regulations for worshiping. Yes. Okay. You got kind of a little bit of where I want to go here. Anybody else?
Hi, Krishna. Please send my obeisances, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. So there's the rules for worshiping God, Krishna, and then there's the spontaneous or not so oriented on external rules, but the internal feelings that don't regard the paradigms of rules, I guess, of worshiping.
Okay.
Would that be the two differences?
You know, I was wondering if anybody would get that at all. And yes, you've kind of hit on it. Both fixes the minds on scripture. Yes, so let's take a look here. This is the logo of the Gaudiya Math. And we cleaned it up a little bit. We put the words in Romanized Sanskrit. This particular logo of the Gaudiya Math was there in the publications. We also modernized the picture of the printing press. Was there in the publications of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. And in a simplified form, it's on the gates to the ISKCON world headquarters in Mayapur Dham. Now, here you can see that Om and Nam is in the center. Then you see the six opulences. Sri, Yasha, Virya, Aishwarya, Vairagya, and Gyan are around the holy name. You see Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at the top. Then you see Tilak with Guru Gaudiya at the bottom. So this is the Sangha. So we have Gauranga at the top and the Sangha at the bottom. And then you see on the right side of the logo is Bhagavatam and Kirtan and Raga Marg. On the left side of the logo is Pancharatra, Archana, and Vidhi Marg. And you see on the right side is Radha Krishna, on the left side is Lakshmi Narayana. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati understood just what you said, that Panchatrika Marg is Vaidhi Bhakti. Bhakti according to the Vidhi. Bhakti according to regulations, where we worship the Lord in reverence and in awe, like Lakshmi Narayan, and it's involved with the rules of worship. And Bhagavat Marg is spontaneous. And this involves especially studying the scripture, printing books, the kirtan of the holy name, and this is in the mood of raga. This is in the mood of attachment, of spontaneity. And generally, Srila Prabhupada describes that first we engage in Vaidhi Sadhana, and then when we are qualified, when we have some at least beginning idea of our relationship with Krishna, we start to engage in Raga Sadhana Bhakti. And there is definitely a difference between Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti and Raga Sadhana Bhakti. One is based on faith. Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is based on faith and to some extent fear, and Raga Sadhana Bhakti is based on attachment. Raga means red, and it also means attachment. That attachment and taste in a particular way. So Srila Prabhupada will often say that they are consecutive, that first there's Vaidhi Bhakti and then there's Raga Bhakti, both of which are forms of practice. But in today's purport, as in many, many other places, Srila Prabhupada writes about them going on simultaneously. So if we look again at today's purport, we will see the Krishna consciousness movement accepts both these processes simultaneously. So this is quite fascinating because, again, we have other instructions in other places about the idea that they're consecutive. You follow the rules, and as you follow the rules, your spontaneity awakens, and then you change your method of sadhana. And as I say, there is a difference between Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti and Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti. The main difference is that in Raghunuga Sadhana Bhakti, one has some awareness, even a very beginning preliminary stage, of the kind of rasa that one has with the Lord. And so one specifically meditates on what's called the ashraya of that rasa, the other devotees, the perfected devotees or the aspiring devotees who have a similar rasa with the Lord. And one also emphasizes and goes deeply into the angas of bhakti, the practices of bhakti that especially nourish one's own inner taste. And in Vaidhi Bhakti, that's not really possible because you don't know anything about your relationship with the Lord, and so there's no way to especially focus on the devotees who have a similar relationship because you don't know what your relationship is, and you can't really focus on the angas of bhakti that nourish your particular taste because you don't know what your particular taste is. So in that way, it's consecutive. But here Prabhupada's talking about how it's simultaneous, and again, there's many, many places where he talks about how it's simultaneous. So how can it be simultaneous? Well, Rupa Goswami talks about in the very beginning of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and Prabhupada also echoes this in the Nectar Devotion, that the main qualification for taking up Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, for taking up regulative devotional service, is a taste. I mean, he talks about that the qualifications, the Kanista Adhikari, the Madhyama Adhikari, the Uttam Adhikari for taking up Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is faith. Faith and knowledge in Shastra, because you're following the regulations of Shastra. And so however much faith and knowledge you have in Shastra would indicate your qualifications for following Shastra. Duh. If I'm going to be following the rules of the scriptures and I don't know the scriptures, then I'm not very qualified to follow the rules of the scriptures. If I'm going to be following the rules of the scriptures and I don't like the scriptures, then I'm not very qualified for following the scriptures. So my knowledge and faith and taste in the scriptures, if I don't believe the scriptures also, I may know them, but if I don't have faith in them, I'm not going to be able to follow them very well. So in one sense, the qualification for taking up regulative practice of bhakti is enjoyment of the scriptures, faith in the scriptures, knowledge of the scriptures. If one has very weak faith and knowledge, then one is Kanista Adhikari. If one has strong faith and knowledge but can't necessarily convince others, one is Majjhima. And if one has strong faith and knowledge and can convince others, one is Uttama. So that is, again, qualifications for starting Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. But Rupa Goswami also gives another qualification for starting Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti as just you like it. Raga, you have a taste, you like it. You can think of it this with food. So if you're going to eat some food, like today at the temple they made this vegan pasta with this fake cheese. And I don't like fake cheese. They like grind up raw cashews or something, I don't know what they do. I just don't like it at all. And so I don't digest it very well. I've tried eating their pasta with fake cheese. And it kind of sits in my stomach and I just sort of feel heavy and I just kind of feel sleepy. I don't like it. So in order to digest it, I have to have some taste for it. Then I would also have to have some faith that this is actually good food, right? If you don't have some faith that it's good food, you're not even going to try it. Like little children will sometimes look at food and go, "Oh, I don't want to try that." So one has to have some kind of faith, one has to have some kind of taste, and one has to have some kind of faith. And one might have to have some kind of knowledge as well, isn't it? You might have to know what is good food and what is not good food. So the qualification for getting a taste, for getting rasa is also what happens. If you digest nicely, your food turns into rasa. Your food turns into energy and gives you the result of eating, which is ojas and tejas. You have energy, you have enthusiasm, you have brightness, you're glowing with health. So in order to do that, your food has to become, by Ayurveda, rasa. So in order to have a rasa with food, you have to have You have to know something about what food is suitable for you, what is good food. You have to have faith in the food, and you have to like the food. Yes? So a similar thing is there with Vaidhi Bhakti. If we're going to follow the scriptures, we have to know the scriptures, we have to have faith in the scriptures, but we also have to like them. And this liking is this raga portion. So this knowledge and faith is this Vaidhi portion, and this liking is this raga portion. And we see that even those of us who are primarily in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, we still have some taste. As Prabhupada explains in the preface to Nectar Devotion, it's this taste, this rasa, that motivates us in anything that we do. Prabhupada's talking about the philanthropist and the family man. You know, there's some taste. I get some pleasure from serving my wife, serving my husband, my children, my dog, whatever. I get some taste from serving humanity, or I get some pleasure out of it. And that sense of pleasure, Prabhupada says, is what drives us on and on. So there is, even for the beginner, there's some pleasure. So Ravindasru Prabhu tells this story of how he went on traveling Sankirtan with Tamal Krishna Maharaj and Vishnujan Maharaj, and they would have this bus with the Radha Damodar deities, and they would go from town to town, and they would set up like a cloth, and they put out instruments, harmonium and tambura and kartels and mridanga, and they would have kirtan. And then they would also be having books available, and then they would serve prasadam. So Ravindasru Prabhu said, he asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, how do you decide which of the people that come to your festivals? They usually set up in like a park to talk to and to cultivate. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj says, well, I see who has a taste. So Ravindasru Prabhu decided to experiment. So after the kirtan and after giving out some books, they were serving prasadam, people were eating, and he went among the crowd and he said, did you like the music? Do you like the books? Do you like the food? And some people said, yeah, it was all right. And other people said, yeah, it was great. So he tried preaching to these two different kinds of people, the people who said, oh yeah, it was all right, and the people who said, yeah, it was great. And he found that when he talked to the people who just said, yeah, it's all right, that he just wasted his time. And when he talked to the people who said, yes, it's great, that they were actually receptive. So in this way, we can see that the Bhagavat Marg of Raga of attachment and the Pancharatriki Marg of Shastra and rules can happen simultaneously. That a person's main motivation can be following the rules, and yet they have some taste and some attraction on the platform. They're on the platform of Vaidhi Bhakti, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, but there's still some attachment. And on the other hand, a person who's on the platform of Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, who's no longer bound by these regulative principles, they still follow the rules to please Krishna. Okay, let's go on to text 4. While all the Prachetas were executing religious rituals and sacrificial ceremonies and thus worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead for his satisfaction, the great sage Narada described the transcendental qualities of Dhruva Maharaj. So that kind of we already knew from the last section. And Prabhupada's talking about here in the purport about that one should always glorify the Lord and also glorify the devotees. Now, I found it very interesting that Prabhupada in this purport starts talking about Varnashram, because there's nothing in the verse itself, nor in the context of this part of the Bhagavatam about Varnashram, but he starts talking about particularly the Varnas. And he's saying here that everyone can glorify the Lord, and that no matter what work you're doing, you can use your work to glorify the Lord. By discharging one's specific duties, one satisfies the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's not a question of necessarily saying, am I a Vaishya or a Shudra or a Kshatriya or a Brahmana, although that's certainly helpful for various things. But whatever I'm doing, whatever I'm good at, whatever I love, whatever I'm doing, whether I'm doing it just to maintain my body, like I have to go shopping and I have to cook and I have to wash the pots and I have to wash the clothes and I have to clean the floor and take care of the car and pay the rent and, you know, that just to take care of the body, or whether it's the actual work I'm doing for my livelihood. You know, I'm working in a bank, or I'm working as a doctor, or I'm writing computer software, or I'm teaching children, or whatever, I'm delivering mail, what I'm doing for my livelihood, or whether it's what we're doing to maintain our relationships, spending time with our family, spending time with our friends, or what I'm doing in the 64 Angas of Bhakti, my 16 rounds, my three Gayatris, my worshipping the deity, my reading the Shastra, any of those things. So we just talked about ashram, varnas, and bhakti, should all be done for the satisfaction of the Lord. That, you know, brushing my teeth can as much be done for the satisfaction of the Lord as having, you know, maintaining my relationship with my parents or my sisters or my children, or making sure that the loans I give at the bank are to qualified people, or giving people proper medical treatment, or chanting my rounds. All of those things can be done to please the Lord. That this concept of whatever I'm doing should be to please the Lord, to glorify the Lord. There was some months ago, I had a doctor appointment, and the, you know, first you check in at the front desk, and so this one gentleman who was there checking in patients, he had some signs up on the wall next to his desk about how he could connect what he was doing to his worship of the Lord. So he was, you know, it was really sweet. And I'm sure that his job was somewhat difficult. You know, if you're a registering person, I think I was going there for some kind of x-rays or something. So I'm sure a lot of the people there, you know, they're sick with various things. And probably a lot of them are in a lot of pain, and maybe they're grouchy. So he had on his sign that to remember that, to be kind to people, to remember that everybody is dear to the Lord, to act in such a way that the Lord would be satisfied with him. So I see sometimes among our devotees, they think that only their aspects of deity worship, their chanting their rounds, etc., are actually in the realm of Krishna consciousness, and the other things they do are some kind of unfortunate maya that they just have to tolerate. This, you know, well, I have to go to work, I have to take care of my house, such a shame, you know, and they don't realize that everything that we do can be a glorification of the Lord and the Lord's devotees. All right. Text 5. Sorry, I have a bit of a cough. So text 5 is, my dear Brahmana, how did Narada Muni glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And what pastimes were described in that meeting? I am very eager to hear of them. Kindly explain fully about that glorification of the Lord. My dear Brahmana, how did Narada Muni glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And what pastimes were described in that meeting? I am very eager to hear of them. Kindly explain fully about that glorification of the Lord. And Srila Prabhupada makes this point that we're able to be just as eager now, 5,000 years later. And that's just so cool. But we can be associating with Narada, we can be associating with Maitreya, even though it's so many thousands of years later. And certainly, one of the great reasons why Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta were so interested in book publication. You know, book publication means that what you're saying can expand in time and in space. And it's even the same for these kind of recorded classes, that, you know, you can say something at one time to just some few people, but it goes out far beyond in time and space. Okay, going to text 6. The great sage Maitreya replied, my dear Vidura, when Maharaj Dhruva departed for the forest, his son Utkala did not desire to accept the opulent throne of his father which was meant for the ruler of all the lands of this planet. You know, everybody wants to be the big king and the ruler. No, not everybody. Some people are like, nope, not for me. So why was this? Going on to text 7, from his very birth, Utkala was fully satisfied and unattached to the world. He was equipoised, for he could see everything resting in the Supersoul and the Supersoul present in everyone's heart. So here is the characteristic of an Uttama devotee, a Mahabhagavat. They see Krishna everywhere. This is something that even a beginner can practice. We can practice this by Krishna is the light of the sun. I have the sunlight streaming in my window. I look out the window and I can see the blue sky lit up by the sun. That is Krishna. Actually, Krishna says he's the light in all luminous objects. So even the light from my computer screen, the lights in my room. Krishna says I'm the heat and fire, the warmth that we feel in our body. Like the warmth we feel in the room, that is Krishna. Our ability to sit, our ability to speak, our ability to hear, to walk, that is Krishna. Our intelligence, our ability to perform austerities. We can actually meditate on that being Krishna. And we can meditate on the universal form, how the clouds, again, I'm looking at the clouds in the sky. They're like the hairs on his head and the trees. The trees just started yesterday. The leaves started coming out in the spring. Those are the hairs on his body. The birds are his artistic sense. Right? Krishna is the sound and ether in so many ways. We can understand that the Lord is everywhere. And we also understand the Lord is everywhere in all the circumstances of our lives. In the good things, the so-called good things, and the so-called bad things. That the Lord is there in all of them. He's always reciprocating with us. He's doing everything. Some months ago, a devotee wrote me when she had a health crisis. And she asked, why did it happen? And I said, I can't tell you exactly the reason. But the overall reason is always love. That everything the Lord does is loving. Everything the Lord does is good. And so we see like that. Now, of course, one thing is that if one is fully absorbed like that, then one doesn't feel any need to interact in the world. That the Lord is everywhere, the Lord is everything. Yes, of course, Mahalakshmi. He's running everything and everything is perfect, so why should I do anything? And this is why generally the Mahabhagavats, the Uttama Adhikaris, don't preach. So we see that this Utkala, he didn't want to manage the world even for the pleasure of God. We were just talking about that whatever we do for the pleasure of God. Whatever we do, whatever we eat, whatever we offer, whatever we give away, should all be done for the pleasure of the Lord. But someone like Utkala doesn't see any need to do anything. As Krishna says, a person like that, they have no reason to do their work and no reason to not do their work. They don't have any reason to depend on any other living being. And therefore, they're not engaged in preaching. So we have some personalities who are just like this, and they just are disengaged in the world. Now, other personalities may act like this at the end of their life. So they may do some. They may apparently come down to the Majjhima platform to interact with the world and then have this complete detachment at the end of their life. Let's go on to 8 through 9. By expansion of his knowledge of the Supreme Brahman, he had already attained liberation from the bondage of the body. This liberation is known as nirvana. He was situated in transcendental bliss, and he continued always in that blissful existence, which expanded more and more. This was possible for him by continual practice of bhakti yoga, which is compared to fire because it burns away all dirty material things. He was always situated in his constitutional position of self-realization, and he could not see anything else but the Supersoul and himself engaged in discharging devotional service. So in this purport, Prabhupada quotes Brahmabhuta Prasanatmana Sochitina Kansatim Sarpas Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param. And he also quotes the first verse of the Shikshastika Cheto Darpanam Arjanam Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam Shreya Kai Ravachandrika Vitaranam Vijavaru Jivanam. And Prabhupada talks about how as we advance in devotional service, we experience param drisva nivartite. We experience a higher taste. And we no longer have interest in the world. Huh? So, generally speaking, even though one is at this platform, one still does service in the world to please the Lord. But if the Lord has nothing that he needs you to do in the world, you may do nothing in the world. It's also interesting that Srila Prabhupada in this purport quotes the Narada Pancharatra, Sarvapati Vinirmuktam Taparatena Nirmalam, the rest of it is Rishikesha Rishikena Sevanam Bhakti Ruchite. He's quoting from Madhulila 19.170. This is the second definition of pure bhakti that Rupa Goswami gives in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. You may all be familiar with the first, Anyabhilasita Sunyam Gyanakama Anavritam Anukulena Krishna Anushilanam Bhaktir Uttamam. So this one, Sarva Upadhi Vinir Muktam, Sarva Upadhi, all upadis, all designations. I am male, I am female, I am black, brown, white, I am tall, I am short, I am fat, I am skinny, I am young, I am old, I am from Portugal, I'm from China, I'm from, you know, wherever, Argentina, I'm from Canada, I have a, you know, Catholic family, I have a Sunni Muslim family, and then, you know, I like this, I don't like that, I'm a conservative, I'm a liberal, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a scholar, I'm a garbage collector, I'm a cook, or even, you know, I'm an introvert, I'm an extrovert, whatever. All of these are all upadis. These are all temporary designations. Some of these change throughout our life. Being old and young change throughout our life. We may get fatter, we may get skinnier. In life, we keep getting taller, and then when you get really old, you start getting shorter. We might change our nationality, right? We might become a citizen of another country. We might change our religion. We might change our political viewpoint. We might change what foods we like to eat. We might change our occupations. And some of this is set for life, and we're only going to change it when we get a new body. But these are all temporary designations. None of them apply to the self. They are very much like a persona that is adopted in a drama or a film. You know, I'm sure that all of us, at least in childhood, were acting in some drama. And in the drama, you pretend to be someone else. You may put on a costume and makeup and a wig so that your external appearance is different. You know, some actors gain a lot of weight or lose a lot of weight for a particular role even, where they put on certain clothing to make them look fatter than they are, or taller than they are. And you also adopt a particular persona for your character that may be radically different from your own persona. I mean, people who are professional actors, they go through many different roles, right? They can play in a drama where they're the hero, and then they can play in a drama where they're the villain. And they can adopt all different kinds of personas. But then the drama is over, and you wash off the makeup, and you take off the costume, and you resume your original self. So as long as we're identified with these changing things of the world, then we tend to act according to these things of the world. You know, if we're some we're some Indian housewife in Mumbai, and then we think, well, what would a good Indian housewife in Mumbai do? And we structure our life around that. We try to be the ideal of our particular designation. But such leads us to a lot of frustration. So all of us are somebody's son or daughter, for example. And if I think, well, I'm going to be a good son or I'm going to be a good daughter. And the problem with this is, like, let's say I want to be a good daughter, all right? So first of all, sometimes I'm not going to be satisfied with what kind of a daughter I am. I'm going to think, you know, well, I could have been a better daughter. And also, my parents have to agree that I'm a good daughter, and they're not always going to think that. Sometimes they'll think I'm a good daughter, and sometimes they think I'm not a good daughter. And then my siblings have to agree. you know, I might think I'm a good daughter, and my parents might think I'm a good daughter, and my sister might say, you're not really being a very good daughter. And maybe other relatives, maybe my parents' brothers and sisters, my aunties and uncles, they might say, well, you're not really being a very good daughter. So then I become frustrated, because I think that's my identity. I'm somebody's daughter. And then if someone tells me, well, you're not doing that very well, then I become offended. Or I may become ashamed, or I may feel guilty. And most of our difficulties in life are because we're trying to be something that we're not. And when we fail at being something that we're not, which we're going to do, then we feel some shame or some guilt or some anger, or, you know, we try to convince the other people, actually, I am really a good daughter. You know, and this is applicable to, you know, I'm a good wife, I'm a good husband, or I'm a good liberal, or I'm a good conservative. I mean, it's so ridiculous. You know, if you give yourself the label of a liberal, then there's some things you can't like and some things you can't agree with, because then you won't be a good liberal anymore. You can't be a nuanced person. And so we become very frustrated with ourselves, we become very frustrated with others. So to give all that up, I am not any of these things. My material emotions, my material thoughts, my material designations have nothing to do with me. They are simply the body and the mind. Mama evam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana mana shastran indriyani prakriti kanistani karshati. I am simply struggling with this body and mind, but I have nothing to do with any of it. And we have probably been all these things. We've probably all been had a lifetime as male, and a lifetime as female, and a lifetime as black, and a lifetime as brown, and a lifetime as pink, and, you know, a lifetime with red hair, and a lifetime with brown hair, and a lifetime maybe as a demigod, and maybe even a lifetime as an animal. And, you know, we've had all these different designations. So instead, bhakti means that I want to focus on who am I? Who am I? I am the spiritual being. And then, nirmala, without any contamination, rishikesha, rishikena, sevanam, bhakti, ruchite, then I can use this body, I can use this mind in the service of the Lord. And that is actual bhakti. Now, Utkala didn't even really use his designations in the service of the Lord. He just stayed as if aloof from the world. And let's go on now to text 10. Utkala appeared to be less intelligent persons on the road to be foolish, blind, dumb, deaf, and mad. Mad meaning like mentally ill. Although actually he was not so. He remained like fire covered with ashes without blazing flames. So if we've ever lit a wood fire, so after some time it just looks like ashes, but underneath the wood is still red hot. So sometimes Uttama Adhikaris or Mahabhagavatas, who are completely free from all the designations of the world and don't have any prescribed service in the world for which they can use their designations, they become completely separate from the world. And they appear to everyone else as if there's something really wrong with them, as if physically and mentally they're severely handicapped. I mean, to be blind, dumb, deaf, and mentally ill. So, you know, a severely handicapped person. And so people just think that they're incapable. We had one child in our movement who died at a very young age, I think about 4 years old, and Prabhupada said that she had never been part of this world, that she had always been existing on a separate platform. Now you can imagine that for Utkala's parents, Dhruva and one of his wives, I forget which one, that it might have been distressful. You know, here you have a child you think will become the next king, and the child seems incapable. But actually, the person was functioning on a much higher platform. And I have a godbrother and godsister who have 5 children, and one of the children was in a terrible accident when he was 3 and became brain damaged. And so his cognitive abilities are impaired. But he's the most devotional, actually, of all of their children. And, you know, I have another friend that she and her husband married late in life. They had a child late in life who has Down syndrome. And it's quite distressing for them. But sometimes these things are actually very, very great devotees who have the external appearance of having nothing to do with the world. All right, text 11. For this reason, the ministers and all the elderly members of the family thought Utkala to be without intelligence and in fact mad. So people didn't recognize his real nature. And this is interesting, of course, because generally we want recognition and we want acknowledgement of our qualities. And here's somebody who has all good qualities and he's acting in such a way that no one will know. Thus his younger brother named Vatsara, the son of Brahmi, was elevated to the royal throne and he became king of the world. And one thing to note is that Dhruva had two wives. So Utkala was the son of one wife and Vatsara, who became the king, was the son of another wife. And I mention this because I've heard some people say that the Dhruva Maharaj story of Suniti and Suruchi is a strong prohibition against plural marriages. And my response to that is, well, if that was true, then why would Dhruva Maharaj have done this himself? So the concept of plural marriages like this is certainly there throughout the Shastra in so many examples. You know, some of our present concepts about actually how things are meant to be are perhaps due to our particular acculturation. All right, and Prabhupada talks about here in the purport about that the monarchy was not an autocracy. So it wasn't that the king could just say, I want this person to be my successor. There had to be an agreement of the ministers. There had to be an agreement of the senior family members. So it wasn't a vote where any Tom, Dick, and Harry could go give an opinion. But it was a vote in that the very intelligent people who were in the know about who was and who was not qualified, they had their opinion mattered. It wasn't that the king just had full power to do whatever he wanted. And this concept of a monarchy as being an autocracy, at least in Vedic standards, is not correct. And of course, there's something, you know, there about how no matter how qualified we are, it's always good to seek advice. Okay, text 12. King Vatsara had a very dear wife whose name was Swarviti, and she gave birth to 6 sons, named Pushparna, Tigmaketu, Isha, Urjva, Vasu, and Jaya. And Prabhupada notes here in the purport that his wife is called Isha, which means a worshipper, or Ishta, which means worshipable. So, not Isha, Ishta. Very dear. But not just very dear, but worshipable, a great personality. And Prabhupada says here that she had the great personality in terms of her being a wife, but one could certainly understand that she was a great personality in general. So not only was the king a very great personality, but the queen was also. Text 13, Pushparna had 2 wives named Prabha and Dosha. Prabha had 3 sons named Pratar, Majadinam, and Sayam. Dosha had 3 sons, Pradosha, Nishta, and Vyusta. Vyusta's wife was named Pushkarini, and she gave birth to a very powerful son named Sarvateja. Sarvateja's wife, Akuti, gave birth to a son named Chakshusha, who became the 6th Manu at the end of the Manu millennium. Nadvala, the wife of Chakshusha Manu, gave birth to the following faultless sons, Puru, Kushta, Trita, Jumna, Satyavan, Urita, Vrata, Agnistoma, Atiratra, Prajumna, Shibi, and Ulmukha. Of the 12 sons, Ulmukha begot 6 sons and his wife Pushkarini. They were all very good sons, and their names were Anga, Sumana, Khyati, Kratu, Angira, and Gaya. And the last verse we're doing today. The wife of Anga, Sunita, gave birth to a son named Vena, who was very crooked. The saintly king Anga was very disappointed with Venu's bad character, and he left home and kingdom and went out to the forest. So this again is a little teaser that Maitreya is putting out for Vidura to incite Vidura to ask more questions. Of course, I'm always struck by these genealogical lists in the Shastra. One of the main reasons that they're there is to establish the historical veracity of the Bhagavatam accounts, that these are not mythology, but these are actual historical accounts. that the Lord and his incarnations are historical figures. But another reason is just to remind us that even if we're a very great and famous personality and king of the world, that some thousands of years ago, all will be is a name in a list that somebody will read through very quickly, and nobody will even remember those names. So we have about 15 minutes. If there's any general questions on anything that we discussed.
Thank you so much, Armula Prabhu. Thank you very much. I just want to mention something that, IFAST, we have hosted so many great personalities. I think you're one of my favorite in terms of hosting. And, you know, it's just I always remember our time here. And I await for your next visit.
Oh, thank you. Well, I will say that I have visited many, many homes in all my years of traveling, and yours is one of my favorites.
Oh, so nice. Thank you so much. So we wait for you to come again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I see we have a question here in the chat. How do we serve material relations as serving and pleasing?
What? May I ask a question, please?
Before this one in the chat? Sure.
Actually, yeah, please. You said, I was just, one thing you said that was really profoundly touching for me is how Krishna, you know, waits for us. I mean, he wants to hear about us. He's like, he's so interested in us. It's just, it explodes my heart to think that, you know, I mean, I can share anything with Krishna, and he's interested, you know, he's not bored. Yes. My mundane life, you know, it's just an amazing thing. It's really profound. And one other question I have is, well, that was a statement. That this is a question. So when we practice Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, as I do, you know, it's just, you know, sort of a practice right now. What's our consciousness? Does Raganuga Bhakti, does it unfold spontaneously, or should I be focusing and attaining Raganuga? How does it work?
Okay, that's an excellent question. A lot of people ask this question. So I think this question is very much like if you have a 10 or 11-year-old child and the child says to you, let's say it's a boy, and then the son says to you, I see that, you know, when people grow up, they have a girlfriend and then they get married. So should I work on that, or will it just happen? And your answer is going to be, it will just happen. That at a certain point of physical maturity, you will find yourself spontaneously interested in girls as romantic partners. So, you know, when you're 8 years old, you don't want to play with the girls. They all have cooties, and you don't want anything to do with them. And then when you're 14 or 15, you're whispering about that pretty girl over there. So it's very much like that, that at a certain level of spiritual maturity, that there arises within us spontaneously a particular kind of emotional attachment to Krishna. And that can happen in many ways. I mean, Srila Prabhupada and Rupa Goswami particularly talk about it happening while reading or hearing. So, you know, you'll read about Mother Yasoda and you'll just, wow, I want to love Krishna as my child. Oh, I'm just so attracted to how Mother is so... I would like to... one of my friends told me she was on the altar serving the deities, and Gorni Thai deities, in a particular temple. And she was hearing class through the, you know, in the temple room. And the person giving class was saying, you know, how would we want to be with Krishna? And all of a sudden she had this strong feeling, I want to play ball with Krishna. I want to run in the fields with Krishna and play ball. So this some sort of feeling will arise. Now, when it arises, the person will generally feel unqualified. And that's, I mean, again, if we want to compare it materially, that if a person starts feeling romantic attachment, generally their first reaction to it is confusion. Yeah? And they may not even understand it. It may not even make sense to them. So the first reaction that most people have to this awakening of a specific feeling is some confusion and some disbelief and some concept of, you know, I can't possibly be pure enough to have such feelings. But the feelings persist because, it's just like, again, for the material example, you know, I tried to play with my toys when I was 13 and I couldn't get any pleasure out of it anymore. It just wasn't there. You know, I was stuck with having a mature body. I wasn't going to be able to go back to being a child again, even if I tried. So in the same way, once one's feeling for Krishna awakens, unless one commits some grievous Vaishnava aparad, it doesn't go away. It persists. And it starts to color how one is engaging in bhakti. It starts to influence how one understands the philosophy. It starts to influence how one chants japa. And at that time, it's a good idea to consult with one's guru or some senior Vaishnavas and discuss what's going on in your life, get some confirmation that actually you're moving in the right direction. And then one intentionally cultivates it, particularly in those two ways, by meditating on the devotees, either the Siddha devotees, Nitya Siddha, or Sadhana Siddha, or even the advanced Sadhaka devotees who have a similar mood to what is awakened in one's heart. And also to especially taking up the limbs of bhakti that nourish that particular feeling in one's heart. For some people, that may be going to lots of holy places. For other people, that may be chanting lots and lots of extra japa. For some people, that may be reading a lot of the pastimes. For some people, that may be doing a lot of deity worship. So initially in bhakti, we tend to go to the aspects of bhakti that resonate with us materially, with our material persona and our material talents. At Raghunuga Bhakti, one sadhana bhakti, it's still practice. It's not perfection, it's still a practice. One especially does those angas of bhakti that nourish one's relationship with the Lord. Srila Prabhupada, as far as what I could understand from the examples that I've looked at, consistently encouraged devotees in this if their attachment was emotional, and consistently discouraged them if their inquiry or interest was intellectual or philosophical. So if someone said, you know, Srila Prabhupada, how do I get from bhava to prema? He would say, don't ask about this. You're not there yet. And when Prabhupada was asked, there's new bhaktas who really feel inspired to be a cowherd boy, Prabhupada said, that is very nice. So it's kind of interesting. Prabhupada would respond favorably when there was actually raga, when there was an emotional attachment, and unfavorably when a person's like, well, I've been around the movement for a while now, I'm ready to start thinking I'm a gopi. And Prabhupada would not accept that kind of behavior. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. We have one in the chat I'd like to get to. How do we serve material relations as serving and pleasing the Lord, because we do our best to serve him with love and details, but thinking if that would cause attachment to material relations? I really like this question. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I see my house as a temple, I see my family members as the Lord's servants, and I am here as the Lord's servant. So imagine if you're, you know, running a temple, or you're running an ashram or a preaching center, and there's people living there. You may have to have a job to get money to help maintain the center, and you're taking care of everybody to help them in their Krishna consciousness. So we can see our family relationships like that. Not that I'm trying to be a good daughter, I'm trying to be a good son, I'm trying to be a good husband or wife or brother or sister, but I'm trying to make Krishna smile. Because sometimes my parents or my spouse or my children or my friends or my employers will be pleased with me, and sometimes they won't. But Krishna will always be pleased with our intention to please him. And it's really that difficult and that simple. How can I deal with my child so that Krishna will be pleased? How can I deal with my customer so Krishna will be pleased? How can I deal with the lady in the shop so Krishna will be pleased? whether the lady in the shop is pleased with me or not, whether my child is pleased with me or not. They may be pleased with me, they may not be pleased with me. And there's no surefire way to make people in this world pleased with you. If you think there is, you're wrong. It just isn't. Something that pleases your spouse on Monday may displease that same spouse on Tuesday. It's just the way it is. But Krishna can always be pleased with the intention to please him. Let me serve my husband to please you. It's a nice letter from Srila Prabhupada to Sacharya in this regard about the husband. It will only increase your material attachments if you think, I'm trying to please this man because he's my husband and because I want to be a good wife. Then you're in the realm of karma. But if you're thinking, I want to please this jiva in order to make Krishna happy, actually I'm not really trying to please the jiva, I'm trying to please Krishna. How would Krishna like me to act with this jiva who has the role of my husband or has the role of my boss or the role of my customer? I like that. Sarah Sheik? Sheik? I don't hear the last name. Sheik?
It's also Shamala Priya.
Oh, hi Krishna, Shamala Priya.
Hi Krishna. So you're actually answering my question as you continue to speak, but I'm wondering if you could speak even a little bit more about, right, this polarity that, well, I sometimes have this polarity where, okay, I'm doing so much. Most of what I'm doing is not devotional service because I'm having to, you know, work and do so many things. And while I feel...
Okay, your connection keeps going in and out. Maybe you could type it in the chat box. But I did pick up on this little thing.
I feel that there's this inner knowing in my heart that I'm connected.
Can you write it in the chat box? Your connection is not very good.
Sure, I'll try to write it in the chat.
Okay. So while I'm waiting for you to do that, I'll ask Mahalakshmi.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So you were mentioning about Anuraga that comes before Mahabhava. But Mahabhava, the vote is only from Srimati Radharani. Then why is it mentioned that before Mahabhava comes Anuraga? If we are never going to tame Mahabhava...
Because Rupa Goswami is describing everything, even if it's something that we're not going to attain. He's still describing everything. He wants everything to be complete.
So maybe because this is the highest, to indicate that this is the highest one
that the jivas can attain. Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
And Samapriya, yeah? Are you writing?
Another thing, maybe.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
In Baba, does the devotee already has a vision of which kind of service is here?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And generally before that, because Raganuga sadhana is a sadhana and Baba is no longer in the realm of sadhana.
Okay. Makes sense.
So in order to do Raga, you cannot do Raganuga sadhana bhakti without Raga. How are you going to do raga nuga without any raga? So you have to have some raga. And for it to be sadhana, that means that your specific attachment has to awaken within the realm of sadhana. Prabhupada says it generally awakens when the anartas are gone or almost gone. So the end of anarta nivritti, somewhere you generally it's going to awaken it around nishta or ruchi. So certainly by bhava it would be there. Now it is possible for a person to stay in Vaidhi Bhakti in the sense of if their attachment is to the Lord in Vaikuntha, or even if they have an attachment in reverence to the Lord in Dwarka, then they stay in some sense and in some way on the Vaidhi platform, even at Bhava and at Prema. Because so Vaidhi can also mean like that a person is not Vaidhi sadhana, they're pure, but their love is so reverential that it's very bound by rules. So therefore we say the residents of Vaikuntha there, and even many of the residents of Dwarka still have this sense of Vaidhi. Vrajalila, wonderful to see you as always. How may I serve you?
Hare Bol, Hare Krishna, Urmila Prabhu. Thank you so much. Thank you. I mean, yeah, you are a walking embodiment of giving realizations to the devotees.
Oh, you just love me, that's all. So how may I serve you?
Yeah, so I'm a little curious about Raganuga. You just clarified from Anartanivritti and moving on. Is in Raganuga, is compassion for all living entities inherent in practicing Raganuga? That means a person has already attained that, let's say, level of compassion, like, let's say, Narada Muni.
Ooh, what a question. So Vishwachagavati Thakur in Madhurya Kanamani talks about nishta in bhakti and nishta in good qualities. And nishta in bhakti he divides into nishta in body, mind, and speech. And he says usually you become first fixed in body, then speech, then mind, but it can happen in another order. So a person may be fixed in thinking of Krishna in their mind and their body's not fully fixed in following everything perfectly. And their speech isn't fully fixed in following everything perfectly. And they might not yet be fixed in good qualities. I mean, frankly, until one is completely pure on the platform of prema, even in bhava, there is going to be some trace of selfishness. And selfishness is the opposite of compassion, is it not? So one is going to see some traces, the examples given of the smell of camphor in an empty camphor pot. So we don't want to look at people and say, well, they just did something that was not very compassionate, therefore they couldn't actually have any higher realization. One has to be careful of that kind of thinking. Does that make sense? You know, and another thing to keep in mind is that even though a sadhana siddha devotee may become pure by sadhana, they're still going to have the particular body that they took birth in. And so they may still have some idiosyncrasies connected with that body and persona, even though they have attained perfection. And that may appear externally as some difficulty with any quality, including compassion. So one has to be a little careful about this. Generally, compassion is going to be achieved in Anartanivritti. Because being lack of compassion is an anarta. So generally, one's raga isn't going to awaken until one has developed at least some reasonable sense of compassion. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to find some traces of difficulty even in an advanced devotee. You will. And you'll find some personal idiosyncrasies that may appear to a particular other kind of person with a different set of idiosyncrasies as some kind of a fault. Does that make sense? You know, my idiosyncrasies are different from your idiosyncrasies. So yours may appear to me as being faulty, and mine may appear to yours as being to you as being faulty. But it's just, you know, we kind of have this, we're still in the same vehicle. That is what it is. And that's not going to change as long as we're in this body. But it's not considered as a fault, although some of these things may appear to be a fault. I can give you a very, very simple example. So some people have a sense of aesthetics. No, the vehicle's not the path at all. The vehicle's the vehicle. How can the vehicle be the path, Mahalakshmi? Your car is not the road. So some people may have a sense of aesthetics, and other people may not have a sense of aesthetics. It just is. Like in India, I can think of two temples that are both gorgeous. The architects, I mean, unbelievable beauty. And in one of these temples, everything is kept very neat. There's no clutter in the temple at all. Zero. The other temple is full of clutter. There's like five different book tables, and a lot of them, they're just some old rusty fold-out table with cardboard boxes underneath, and there's posters stuck up on the table from 1 year ago, and, you know, and there's five of them in the temple room. And then there's posters advertising festivals for the last 3 years, and nobody takes them down. And it's just clutter everywhere. So you have these two beautiful temples, one that's maintained neatly and one that's not. And this is probably due to the fact that the leaders in these two places, one has a sense of aesthetics and one doesn't. You know, and probably an astrologer could look at their chart at the placement of Venus and figure it all out immediately by looking at the chart. So it may appear that somebody has a fault, but they may be fully... In fact, the person with the cluttered temple may love Krishna more than the person with the neat temple. The person with the neat temple, it may just be their material neatness, and the person with the cluttered temple, it may be some residual problem. Does that make sense? So one has to be very careful.
Yes, thank you very much. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, so... Yeah. So now we have this question in the chat. How do we glorify the Lord during all of our daily activities that are not direct devotional service? There's no question of direct or indirect. It's direct if you make it direct. Like if you're chanting Hare Krishna and you're thinking that you want a new shiny red car and $1 million in your bank account, that's not direct devotional service even though you're chanting Hare Krishna. Like Prabhupada talked about professional Bhagavatam reciters and professional deity worshippers. So you can be reciting the Bhagavatam and worshipping the deity and chanting Hare Krishna completely for material purposes. And you can be brushing your teeth and driving to work and changing your baby's diapers to love Krishna. And if you want to know how to do it to love Krishna, I would refer you to Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, verses 13 through 20. How can you love Krishna? Do we have... Okay, Millard Hawkins, and I can hardly see you. Is that Madhvacharya?
Hare Krishna.
Oh, there you are. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. It's good to hear you, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
I had a quick question. In terms of loving our wives or our husbands or our children because this is pleasing to Krishna. I was thinking that, could that be seen as a little impersonal in that, it's not about you, it's about pleasing Krishna. But actually, these people, these personalities around us, you know, compassion means connection and appreciation of the person for their... the qualities of Krishna that are present in their unique way in them. And then,
But isn't that part of how you would please Krishna? If you took care of your family members in an impersonal way, would Krishna be happy?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I mean, suppose I asked you to babysit my child. I said, would you please... I have to go away for a week somewhere, and can I leave my child with you in your home, and you take care of my child? So, you're taking care of your child out of friendship with me, to please me. But I would hope you would take care of my child in a personal way, appreciating the unique features of my child, and not just as a job. Well, I'm just taking care of you as a job to please Urmila. That wouldn't please me. You know, and I'd come back and my kid would say, yeah, you know, it was all mechanical. I'm just doing this for Krishna. I'm not doing it for you. I mean, like, I wouldn't be happy. And if I came back and you said, wow, you know, your son, I was really appreciating how nicely your son was doing this. And and I was really seeing how he has these qualities, and this is something he needs to work on, and we did this together, and I'd be thrilled. So the difference is whether I'm thinking, I'm taking care of this person because he is my son and I am the father. And I am a good father. I'm doing this to be a good father. I mean, then if my son is mad at me and tells me I'm not the perfect father, which your kids will almost definitely do when they get to be adults, and they'll also do it when they're around 2 and 3, then you're going to be devastated. Or if your spouse says to you, you know, I didn't like the way you were dealing with our son this morning. What do you mean you don't like? I was, you know, but I'm not doing it to be a good father. I'm not doing it for my material designation. I'm doing it so Krishna will smile. That actually gives us more love and more appreciation, because it takes out the need for material recognition and the need for material appreciation. I'm getting my recognition and appreciation from Krishna. If the kid is happy with me or the kid is not happy with me, is Krishna happy with me? Yeah. Is that all right?
It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. What a wonderful question. We had a question here in the chat. Is practice of Raganuga Bhakti from the onset a spiritual suicide? If it's real Raganuga, it's not suicide at any time. Raganuga is not an intellectual decision. It's not like you finished high school and now you're going to go to college because you're a certain age or something. It's the awakening of one's genuine emotional relationship with Krishna. So if that is awakened from day one, then it's awakened from day one. That's unusual. That would generally be due to very strong practice of bhakti in previous lifetimes, or due to some extraordinary mercy of a devotee. So that's unusual, but it could certainly happen. If it's genuine, it's genuine. It's never suicidal to do something genuine. If you've been in the movement for 50 years and you have no genuine awakening, then it's suicidal. It's not a certain amount of time. It's when is there a genuine awakening. That might happen after 2 days and it might not happen for 30 years. It's not a particular time like that. Usually, a person has a lot of anarthas in the beginning of their practicing of Krishna consciousness, and therefore, the awakening of those feelings is very unlikely. Artificial practice of Raganuga Bhakti is very foolish. If you think about, you know, families who try to push their children to have a certain occupation for which the children aren't suited. You know, you have to become a doctor or you want to be as a jazz musician. You know, you have to be an IT specialist when all you want to do is be a teacher. And it's harmful for the person. So if a person tries to perform Raganuga Bhakti when they haven't actually had an awakening of their relationship with Krishna, they may be practicing something that's not them. If you're naturally a cowherd boy and you start making some practice as if you're a gopi, it's going to hinder the awakening of your cowherd boyness. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that it's very dangerous to be artificially practicing something that you're not. Krishna likes authenticity. So it's not a question of years, it's a question of being authentic. And if it's authentic, it's good. If it's not authentic, it's bad. It doesn't matter if it's 1 week or 1 year or 5 years or 20 years. And to not practice when it's authentic is just as bad, actually. So to practice something artificially is bad. To pretend that you're, you know, in the mood of Krishna's father when you have no idea who you are, that's bad. But if that's actually awakened in you, not to cultivate it is also bad. That awakening is Krishna sending an invitation and saying, hey, come restore your relationship with me. No, I'm not going to do that. I mean, that's not a happy place to be. Like I say to people, if you're chanting Hare Krishna, and then Krishna knocks on your door and say, here I am, and you say, I'm not advanced enough, go away. I mean, that's not pleasing to Krishna. How does one cultivate one's raga? I already said. the two main ways is that you specifically meditate on devotees who have a similar mood, and you specifically engage in the angas of bhakti that nourish your particular mood. Those are the two main differences between Vaidhi Sadhana and Raganuga Sadhana. And Loka Devi Dasi, and then we will end.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you so much for class. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
We met when you were here in Gainesville. So my question actually, I have several questions, but the one that's popping up right now is I'm listening to conversations about compassion, because we talk about it as a yatra a lot, and we talk about it as devotees a lot. And I'm wondering how you would distinguish compassion from sentimentality.
All right. Sentimentality, senta menta, it means of the senses and the mind. So the compassion is also called karuna ras. Karuna ras is also identified with lamentation or grief. Like, you know, you read a sad book or you hear a sad story, you watch a sad movie and you cry. That's a kind of karuna ras. You're feeling some kind of grief. You know, Romeo and Juliet or something. You know, oh, they're both dead. Ah, they misunderstood each other and they've died. Ah. So that's a kind of karuna. And in the topic of rasa, Romeo and Juliet is mostly karuna rasa. When we're talking about compassion, we're talking about either on the material level as karuna rasa, which is all material rasas and emotions are sentiments. And we can also talk about the genuine karuna rasa on the spiritual platform. So the material rasa of karuna rasa is not going to be fully satisfying to anybody. It's not going to be fully satisfying to the person who's crying, and it's not going to be fully satisfying to the person who's hurting, because it's all on the platform of material designations and falsity. Now, better to have compassion for people than to be mean to people, even on the material level. I mean, duh. You know, it's far better, like it's better to be in Rajagun than Tamagun. It's better to be in Sattvagun than Rajagun. You know, it's better to be married and take care of your spouse and be a responsible family person than to just be a, you know, irresponsible, promiscuous person. But being a responsible family person isn't spiritual. So we'd rather that people were like Krishna says, don't ever give up charity. Charity can be connected to compassion, doesn't have to be. Charity is a subcategory of the chivalrous rasa, not a subcategory of the compassionate rasa. But Krishna says charity should never be given up. And it's good to make that distinction. You know, compassion, strictly speaking, is rather passive as a rasa, like you're just crying. If you do something, then it starts to go into chivalry, it starts to go into heroism. And especially it's the dhanavir and the dharmavir aspect of chivalry. Dharmavir, you're righteous, you're doing the right thing, and dhyavir, you're giving in charity. Charity doesn't have to be money, charity could be time. Charity could be advice. There's so many things you can give in charity. You could give your home. So it's very active and it's in a mood of heroism. Now, the kind of compassion that we're looking for on the spiritual platform is very much connected with Krishna. Karuna ras having to do with Krishna usually has to do with you're lamenting that Krishna's in some trouble, or you're lamenting that Krishna's friends are in some trouble, or you're lamenting that your friends or family are in trouble. And it's giving you a sense of sorrow. But again, if you do something about it, that becomes heroism. And if you're doing that to please Krishna, then that's a genuine rasa. If you're doing that because you want to feel that you're a great hero and you want to feel that you're very righteous and you're very caring and you're very compassionate, then it's within the modes. Usually Rajagun, but it can also be in Sattvagun. It can also be sometimes in Tamagun. there are tamagun kinds of heroism and tamagun kinds of charity. Now, Krishna says no one should give up charity. Even the great souls shouldn't give it up. So, again, charity is not just money. But giving something to help somebody who's less fortunate than yourself. Again, it could be time. It could be your time and energy to just listen to somebody. It could be you let them sleep in your couch. You give them a meal. But that's all in the realm of charity. It's a different rasa. I hope that doesn't complicate things for you.
Very helpful. It's actually very helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay. I see that compassion also, if we think of compassion in terms of empathy, that like I feel sorrow at someone else's sorrow, it helps us to not be so harsh with people, especially when people hurt us or when someone's going through some kind of difficulty. You know, as it cannot be in the modern parlance, judgmental. You know, but to see that everybody has their struggles, I have my struggles, everybody has their struggles. And I can't really, I'm not in a position to sit as a judge and jury over other people's struggles and how they're responding to it. But I want to feel sorrow with them. In fact, that's really what compassion means, to suffer with somebody. Srila Prabhupada sometimes defines that spiritual life means that you other people's sorrow is your sorrow and other people's happiness is your happiness. And material life is you rejoice when other people suffer. And you're envious when other people are happy. So in that sense of compassion, it's an essential feature of spiritual life to have empathy with others and to feel with them. Is that also helpful?
Very much. And I think one of the things I really appreciated about what you said is putting it in the realm of how is my expression of compassion pleasing Krishna, as opposed to just pleasing my own sense of what I should be doing or what they might need or even what they might think they might need. But that focus, which really comes out from your entire class, of I'm focused on pleasing Krishna.
Yes.
In this way that I'm giving or the way that I'm being with this person.
Yes. Yes. It can be tricky because in Satvagun, one is feeling some happiness internally from being a balanced, harmonious person who's also going to be caring. So it's going to be, I am a wonderful person because I'm so full of compassion and caring. I really have empathy for everyone and therefore I am such a spiritual person. Right? I mean, that sense of like this, I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm connected. I'm empathic. Oh, does that feel good? So that's just ego in sattva. And then ego in rajas is, I care about people. I don't let people suffer. When I see that someone needs me, I drop everything. I sacrifice. I go and I help them. Did you notice that? I want you to notice that. I want thanks for that. I want... Hey, you didn't mention my name. And then in Thomas, it's, you need some help? Sure, it's easy for me. I can help you if it's easy. Sure. You need some help? It's going to be too hard. Forget it. Yeah, look, I'm a real boundary person. I have my boundaries, you know, like I'll help you if it's convenient. Sure. I'm not going to stress myself. That's ego and Thomas. Having said that, compassion also means that one takes care of oneself. Self-compassion is very important. What I've seen too is it's impossible to be compassionate to others if we're not compassionate to ourselves. Impossible.
Yes.
If I have this, you know, really loud inner critic all the time going at myself about how terrible I am and how fallen I am, it's going to come out of my mouth and out of the pores in my body in dealing with other people. I haven't seen any exception to that. You know, the passive-aggressive, sarcastic, niggling critic of themselves is also going to be the passive-aggressive, sarcastic, niggling critic of everybody else. Well, I do it to myself, too. It's like, uh-huh. Well, you're part of Krishna, too. So I that's also important. You know, I'm just a human being in Kali Yuga this time around, and I'm going to make lots of mistakes, probably every day. You know, it's Kali Yuga, and I'm human. And I'm allowed to be a human in Kali Yuga because that's it. You know, so I'm going to be kind to myself. I'm going to make sure that I take care of myself. I'm going to make sure I get enough sleep and I get enough food to eat and enough exercise and enough time for myself. And I'm going to take care of myself. And without doing that, being compassionate to others is, I just don't see that it's possible. It does not work. You know, I'm part and parcel of Krishna too. But I should be taking care of this person because they're part of Krishna, and I love Krishna, or I want to love Krishna. And he wants me to take care of his devotees, and Krishna will smile. And then it becomes a rasa, it becomes ecstatic, even if you're crying. All right, we have gone way over time. I know we started a little bit late. I hope everybody's happy. And if there's more we want to know, well, we can always keep studying the books over and over and over again, and as they are ever fresh, we will keep learning more and more and more. So whatever good you have seen and heard in this class is due to Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas, and all of the mistakes here are my own. Please follow in the footsteps of the acharyas who have given me something I can pass on, and please do not emulate my mistakes. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Thank you so much.